Hi, ActiveFister.ca is happy to present a recording of David McGee's talk, Lost Ottawa, Facebook, Community, and History in the 21st Century. What does it all mean? You can find recordings of other talks at ActiveHistory.ca.
Hey, good evening. First, let me say thanks to Andrew for organizing everything this evening, and thanks to the association for sponsoring the event and inviting me here. I want to say thanks to you in the audience for coming out to hear about Lost Ottawa and what it might mean about the future of history, which is a pretty big title, I must say. I'm going to go through my talk, but my goal is really to raise a bunch of points about history, about local history, about the internet, so that maybe we could have a really good discussion when we get to the end. So I want to begin my talk today by looking at the last big project I was in. You see it here. It's called, is it in focus, by the way? I can't see that far. the project was called The Book of Michael of Rhodes. And as you see it here, it's a three-volume edition of a medieval manuscript written by a young man who fled his native Rhodes to join the Venetian Navy in 1401. Starting off at the very bottom of society as an oarsman on a galley, Michael rose to the highest positions that a non-noble could have in the Venetian Navy, called admiral, actually, in a career that spanned 44 years, in which he made grueling annual voyages to places like Trebizond, Alexandria, Constantinople, London, Bruges, and alternated those voyages with years in the military galleys, fighting in several sea battles against the pirates, Genoese, and against the Ottoman Turks. Along the way, Michael wrote a manuscript of over 400 pages that included a large section on mathematics, navigation, lunar calculations, shipbuilding, a manuscript that was lost for over 400 years before it turned up at Sotheby's in the year 2000. At that time, I was working at the Dibner Institute for the History of Science and Technology at MIT, and our organization set out to buy this manuscript. And as you can imagine, some hilarity ensued when the very first bid was way beyond our maximum of $325,000. So we had to, like, don't wink, don't nod, don't raise your hand, don't do anything. We don't want to buy this by accident. However, the very wealthy man who did the manuscript was made aware of our interest, and he graciously made it available to us for study. To make a long story short, we ended up deciding that it was our duty to preserve the manuscript for future scholars by making an edition of the text. And that's the three volumes you see here. So the one volume is a facsimile of the text. We did a transcription and translation on facing pages with separate series of footnotes running down each side. And then we did a third volume of essays scholarly essays on the topics, right? And, oh, by the way, that one's by me. To make this edition, we assembled an international team of experts from Italy, Germany, and North America. We spent over $600,000 in grant dollars and grant money from various sources on our research on our website. In the end, we still needed an additional $60,000 grant as a subvention because otherwise no publisher would publish it, right? In other words, we had to pay for the publishing ourselves for, I think we only printed like 1,000 copies. It was an amazing project, and I was the project manager with special responsibility for the facsimile and also for the website. And while working on the website, I remember this day telling my wife that I had finally mastered how to do long division the medieval way. And then I remembered, oh, yeah, I don't really know how to do it the modern way. I forgot that. Okay, but why am I telling you all this? Well, what I'm trying to say is that my background is in what we would maybe call, and I sometimes call, nerd work. This kind of thing is absolute nerd work of the old school. It doesn't get any nerdier than making an addition, right? That's nerdy even inside academia. And it doesn't get any nerdier for than making an addition for, you know, maybe the 20 or 30 people in the whole world who are interested in medieval mathematics, right? So the question is then, with that as a background, how the heck did I end up as the proprietor of a lost Ottawa Facebook community scrounging around in desperation for more likes? Now, the answer to that, I blame E.B. Eddy, whose collection we acquired at the Science Museum. And accordingly, as the archivist, I thought maybe it would be a good idea to read the history of E.B. Eddy, only to discover that there wasn't one. I says to myself, no history of the arguably the region's most successful and longest-lasting company? To me, that was astonishing, especially with my background in history of technology. In any case, I thought I'd better read up on my history of Ottawa. And then once again, I realized that, gee, although there's several books and there's lots of people interested in the history of Ottawa, I was surprised to find that there are really so few books. Right? So few books about the nation's capital, right? And almost no academic histories, and particularly very little on the last 50 years. Right? There's some really good work on early stuff, but this really, really made me wonder. And even if you go to the bookstores, you go in there and you go to the Ottawa section, you see there aren't hardly any books, right, on the history of Ottawa. It's very peculiar for a national capital. Right? So that really made me wonder. I said, like, don't the people who live here like the place enough to write about their own town, right? And in many ways, though, I must say at the urging of my wife, Ann Battis, I started Lost Ottawa with that kind of question in mind to find out how do the citizens relate to their own city. There's a second reason, though, that I want to start off talking about Michael of Rhodes, because I think all told, we spent about $1 million on that project. That is the kind of money you can only get in academia, right? And maybe only in academia in the United States, right? Even if you can get it there, right? That's a lot of money. And even as I say, we had to pay for our own publishing, right, in the end. And there's just no way you can get that kind of money for local history, and not as a private citizen. And so that means that there's very, very few people who have the time to do serious research. I mean, even if they did, the bottom has fallen out of the publishing. So what would they do? So what I'm trying to get at here is that it seems like the business model for local history in particular, it has collapsed, right? And that's really the reason why you don't find many books on Ottawa history in the bookstores, because that business model has collapsed. So against this rather doomy and gloomy setting, what are we to make of the internet and of the growing success of Lost Ottawa? We want to ask ourselves, is history dead? Is the business model so broken that history is dead? Or is there a new model? Is there something new we can do? Is there life after death? All these kinds of questions you ask, especially as you get older. So these are some of the questions I want to raise today. But before I try to come up with some answers, I want to examine Lost Ottawa more closely. We'll start by looking at what it is. We'll start by looking at some statistics, and then I want to look closer at several examples to see what people are doing on Lost Ottawa and what kind of history they're consuming. And then we'll come back to discuss what something like Ottawa, Lost Ottawa might mean for the 21st century. Okay, so let's just take a quick look at it for those who I might not be familiar with it. First of all, Lost Ottawa is a Facebook community page. That's kind of a technical term, actually, and making use of an online technology provided for free by Facebook. If we just move over to the next page here. It's a community page devoted to the history of Ottawa, but really to Outaouais. And the idea is that life in the region has changed rapidly over the years, and that the page seeks to capture some of these changes via picture, capture some of these things that have been lost. Okay, so when you're making a Facebook site, all right, you've got to have some kind of name. So we kicked them around, and we came up with Lost as our idea. And there is, however, some meaning to it, because we wanted to say, well, okay, lost, what does that mean? Well, lost as in gone, lost as in not there anymore. But ultimately, we thought it's more like lost from memory, because people had forgotten about it. Even if it was still there, they had forgotten. And in this sense, what's lost could really be practically anything. A song, a building, a place, an event, a product, kind of anything that members of the community think would be interested, think others would be interested in remembering. Anybody can see the page, actually, although you might have to get rid of the annoying Facebook thing that shows up and tries to get you to sign up. Anyone who is a member of Facebook can join the community by simply liking the page. I think we have to go forward here. There's a like button up there. You click on like. Once you like the page, you can post pictures and add captions, and you can comment on other people's photos. You can post queries and so on. So I got to keep looking out the side of my eye here to see that it's actually changing. And I'm not going backwards like I just did. Okay, so pictures, posts, captions, and comments. Those are the four building blocks of Lost Ottawa. And the pictures, of course, are the keys. And these pictures are generally of two kinds. The first kind are pictures that are posted by me. And here's a typical chunk of a page which shows two pictures of a school trip that 1,300 or so school kids from the Eastern Townships made to Ottawa in 1962, I think it was. Below it, you can see, where the people have commented on the pictures. And here you can see some of the things that people could do. They could like it, they could comment, they could share it. And in this case, at the time the screen grab was made, only a paltry 19 people liked that. I slaved over that picture. You see that liking is really important part of Facebook. And who wouldn't like a picture of a nun with a giant telephone? Right? Come on. Like a portable telephone from, 61, right? And then, who wouldn't like a picture of a giant snowman holding a dow? And wouldn't the dow go good now? Right? We have a picture of a couple out for a Sunday stroll among the cannonballs that used to adorn Nepean Point. And above is one of my typical captions, no longer than three paragraphs, generally one sentence for each paragraph, where I provide some facts. And in this case, a kind of implied question about when did the cannons disappear? And you see that a lot of people liked the pictures, and many people shared it. And you see the comments where one wag joked that maybe the cannons were taken away because they all seemed to point at Quebec. Here's another picture pointed by me, posted by me, this time photos of the construction of the French embassy on Sussex in the 1940s, 37, I think. There's a nice ghost on the left. I like those. In my caption, I used the word spiffy a few times, and this led to a whole bunch of comments that you can see over there if you can read them. It's like some people said great shots, but others declared that spiffy was their new favorite word. And this is actually one of the features of Facebook, of the Lost Ottawa, is actually there's a lot of this kind of humor, low-level humor going on all the time. Sometimes I confess that I break my own rules, which is that we say that we're from the dawn of time up to the year 2000. And the idea from that was we wanted to basically get print pictures and not digital pictures, because we figured that in some way, what's digital and only 10 years old isn't lost really. But sometimes I break my rule. And this is another kind of recurring feature, which is a kind of photo album you can make in Facebook. And I generally use this to illustrate outings that you could take to something that's lost, right? In this case, it's the pillars of what this very building used to be in the Rockeries, which many people have never heard of, right? So lost in some way. And then this one here is another kind of lost thing. If you go on the bicycle path along the Quebec side and you end up at Deschenes Rapid, you see all these ruins. Many people have no idea what they are. Actually, it's a very confusing sight, I have to say. Now the other kind of picture that is on Lost Ottawa that you see here, and in fact the vast majority are those that are posted by community members. And here I've just chosen a couple of selections at random. On the left, we have the front page of an Ottawa Today story about the Queen visiting the Rough Riders. That was their first edition ever. On the right, a postcard of the Churchill Arms Motel torn down in the 80s, according to the poster. Sometimes it's not clear whether the facts are straight. People quite liked that picture, and one person commented that, as they said, oh, my very first live performance was there. And then they thought, oh, yeah, but that's the Churchill Arms Motel. And so they corrected themselves to say, it was a performance as a live musician. here's another selection just to give an idea of some of the pictures. One on the left is a picture of a marathon swimmer, which was posted by the Jewish Archives. The other is an aerial shot of the Breton Flats and the Roundhouse, and aerials are actually quite popular also on the site. I'm going to go up here just to show you that you can actually see the pictures in a completely different way, kind of like a photo album. And again, if you look at the pictures, you can kind of see the variety of things that are posted. Places, people, a lot of ones about drinking, I must say, and events. Okay, so now we've sort of discussed that, gee, maybe this Lost Ottawa is popular in some way. And so let's just discuss a little bit of stats to say, well, how popular is it and what does that mean? I want to enter a caveat at this period because I have to deal with what are Facebook statistics and how they actually calculate these things. This is always a bit mysterious. But anyways, that being said, the key Facebook measure is likes. And as of Saturday, when this picture was grabbed, we had 12,327 likes. I think we've gone up something like 60 by then. And that makes Lost Ottawa, so far as I know, the largest of the historical Facebook sites in the city. So each museum has one, Ottawa Archives has one, and various places have one. But I think this is the biggest. The next stat over that you see there, so there's our likes. The next stack goes over is another Facebook measure, which counts the number of unique people who have interacted with the page, and they say talking about. But it really means the number of people who have interacted with the page in some way, either by liking a picture, by commenting on a post, or sharing a post with some others. So that is 2,000 people just didn't look at the page. They actually did something, right? Facebook provides another stat related to this called engagement, which is the total number of likes and comments and shares. And that number for the week was 6,881. And that means that those 2,000 people who were talking about Lost Ottawa actually did 7,000 distinct things. That's a big number. That's a big number, and hence they call it engagement. Finally, though, if we look at the last figure over there, we see reach, which was 31,013 for that week. And reach is defined as the total number of unique people who have seen the content associated with Lost Ottawa, visiting the page, whether they liked it or not, whether they're Facebook members or not, or saw the content because it was sent to them somehow, shared to them by another social media or whatever. So that means that in that week, some 30,000 people saw Lost Ottawa content. So all things are relative, of course, but just to put these figures in a little bit of perspective, I could say that my museum would kill for such numbers. They would love it if that many people came to their website in the same period. They would love it if that many came in the door, right? And you can also say that if you were an author, well, who wouldn't want 2,000 active readers in a week, not to mention buyers of your book, and who wouldn't kill for 31,000 customers if you were writing local history? Okay, so want to move on here to say, so who are these people who are consuming Lost Ottawa? And if we go by likes here, we see this distribution. First of all, pretty well half men and half women. More or less reflecting the differences in the population at large. Below, in these stats below, you're going to see that the largest group of users are from Canada and from Ottawa, which is not very surprising. But we have quite a few people from the U.S., Australia, Italy, and so on, and that's quite interesting. And we get comments from them saying, "Yeah, I'm so lonely here in, you know, Florence." And, you know, I just got to have pictures of home. So there's one figure here, though, that I don't think is accurate. And this is a bit anecdotal, but going by the names of the people I see every day posting or commenting or liking or doing all these things, I would believe that we have many more French speakers than the stat says, because it says overwhelmingly that people are English speakers. But again, like by going by what I see, I think that's not correct. And my guess is that what happens on Facebook is that the bilingual people just kind of sign up and say, all right, English, when they're filling out their little preference thing, which you have to do. And that's why the stat is so high. The big surprise on the page, however, is the age breakdown, I would say, because as you could see, if you can see that far, is the vast majority of likers are between 25 and 55. And the biggest group is those aged 35 to 44. And hopefully we can turn to the next one reach here. So unfortunately it's a bit smaller, but it's more or less the same thing. So those were the people who actually liked the site. Those are the members. These are the people who were reached by the site. And it's more or less the same breakdown. We have people between 25 and 64. And the biggest group is, again, those aged 35 to 44. So this might, maybe it shouldn't surprise me, because actually I ended up on Facebook in the first place because my 86-year-old dad insisted. Right? But I guess the main point is that we're not talking about kids here. These are not the consumers of Lost Ottawa. Facebook, at least especially in Lost Ottawa, it's not about kids on their phones. Okay, so if Lost Ottawa is history and it has this audience, what kind of history are we talking about here? What's going on in the kitchen? So let me just start here with a really quick one. We're going to come back to these pictures as we go, but I just want to point out that these are the five most popular pictures on Lost Ottawa as calculated by a program called SocialSafe. And what's notable is that they're all from 1960 and afterwards. And not one of them is one of those nice old black and white pictures like I put up every morning. Nevertheless, I am going to start with a black and white picture. This is the old R.J. Devlin house on the cliff above the Ottawa River where the Supreme Court now stands. And I would like to use it to illustrate what I was thinking when Lost Ottawa was started back in February of 2013. And in essence, what I wanted to do was put up pictures that, even if they were old, would mean something to people in their everyday life. And my focus, or my, you know, first idea was that I would use pictures of the built environment, which I thought people could relate to either because the building was there, but they learned about something and they passed it every day, and then they would think about what they learned, or maybe it wasn't there anymore, and they would go by the Supreme Court and go, oh yeah, there used to be this incredible house on that cliff. You know, just something like that. I said to myself, don't overthink it. So now I'm overthinking it. And in any case, this was part of a series about the properties that were northwest of Bank and Wellington, which were all expropriated and cleared in the 30s. And it's kind of interesting because everybody talks about the Breton Flats, but there actually was a previous clearance, and it was on the top of the hill. The series was very successful, and I got some nice comments like, I've enjoyed this series, and I really hate to see it finish. That is so neat. Never thought of what was there before. Thanks for creating a wonderful community. I've been browsing for hours. Oh, I like that one. But my favorite is the one that you can actually see on the page. Hang on. Isn't that the primary resident of Senator Duffy? Here's another picture of the built environment in a way. It's Baseline and Merivale Road back in the day. It's kind of interesting because it's not really the type of historical picture you would put on your calendar or whatever. It's kind of nondescript picture of a nondescript place, but it got a very powerful response, actually. Now, I guess, in a way, we kind of regard it, or many people do anyways, if you live in Canada, like this is downtown, right? But other people immediately compared those fields to their own experience to comment with like some amazement on how much the city had changed and how much it had grown in a relatively short time. Here's the picture that was really the first gigantic eye-opener for us. It's a postcard of the Green Valley Restaurant that was located on Prince of Wales in the 1950s. The picture is from the 50s. It was on Prince of Wales. I never went to this restaurant. So I just did my usual research. I found out that, Green Valley opened in 1935 as a tourist camp and eventually burned down around 2003. I never really did get the exact date of when it burned down. So I was really, really surprised by the response. At that time, we had not very many likes, actually, and so about some 219 people liked it, 64 shared it, but almost 11,000 people saw the post. And that was more than five times the number of members of the community or likers that we had at the time. So we were going, whoa, what's up with that? You know, you're kind of watching the ticker as it keeps going up and up. We were so amazed that we actually put up another picture of the dining room. Do I have that? Here we go. Yep. And got another similar outpouring about a second picture, right? And so that's the dining room on the left with people considering what they're going to eat. And the main point here, I guess, is that the Green Valley was an Ottawa institution where thousands of people seem to have gone, particularly as kids. People mentioned the weddings they went to, the anniversaries. One person mentioned the bad date they went on there. Others mentioned, maybe, I'm not sure about the tone, but their dinners with grandma. Dinners out for the family, special occasions. Many people remembered the giant Christmas tree that used to be outside. Many others remembered Shirley Temples and these animal swizzle sticks that hung off the side. Many, many more people remembered the Mickey Mouse ice cream. And in short, people had these really, really direct memories of the place, which they started to talk about and they started to share. And then there started to be crosstalk between them about what was going on. Also taught us that one of the kind of important talk or subject that we could work with in Lost Ottawa was food or eating or restaurants. So let's move to another picture now. This is a CFRA swing set from 1966, for those who remember those. This was another one which got an astonishing number of people. We had 10,600 people saw this picture. 156 people liked it, 62 shared it, and it had 47 comments. These were kind of about shared experience. Of course, there was some complaining about CFRA as a talk radio station, and one person joked, it's like, oh, LOL, which is kind of funny for all these people who were like 40 years old, right, who had the site going, LOL. CFRA used to do something other than complain about everything? This actually provoked someone from the station to point out that CFRA is actually still the number two station in the city, so that they must have done something right. But you know, people in Ottawa like to complain. But most people actually just remembered their experiences. Several spoke about General Grant, some about Al Pussycat Pascal. One person wrote that he used to ride his bike to the station every week to pick up the swing set and see what the top hits were. Others, one person asked if anyone remembered 45 records. I said, oh yeah, I do. Others spoke about the songs the first time they heard them and so on. And the takeaway here, though, is that music was another one of these subjects that's part of integral part of life and life in Ottawa that people remember and that they consider part of their history. Let's move on to this bus, which is kind of a good one. Crappy photo, right? Really bad. I had entitled it "Your Morning Commute" just to try and maybe get people to think about commuting and maybe they take the bus or whatever. And, you know, but again, I was really surprised by the reaction because this ended up with almost 10,000 views, and you know the norm is somewhere around 5, maybe 6 or something. And again, there was an amazing number of comments. Another outburst of this shared experience. Some agreed with me, saying how awful the combination of colors, smells, and rattling was, and that it made them sick. Right? One person said he always went to the back of the bus because the bumps were the biggest there. Okay, go figure. Many people recalled the routes they took by number, and they would say, yeah, I used to take the 42, and it would blah, blah, blah. Here's one. The 41 bus was one of the worst. So many turns. Plus, if you sat near the back, the diesel fumes made you sick. When I went to Algonquin College, I started every day with a headache. But my favorite comment in that one, and I think there's a little mix-up about dates here and also about memory, but it's a nice comment anyways. I would ride these with my little girlfriend in 1953 all the way from Gladstone to downtown Andrew Fleck Daycare Center on King Edwards with our moms, and we would both be singing "Once I Have a Secret Love" at the top of our lungs. Man, that was a magical, beautiful time to be alive for sure. Right? So that's a great one. We got a similar response for this Goodbye Ottawa streetcar. Several people commenting on this day in particular and how it is that the slogans got ended up riding on the streetcars in 1959 when they were phased out. I don't want to spend time on it, but I just do want to say that this is one of those examples where between the old streetcars and the new LRT, it's like a hot button issue, and you get quite a bit of complaining and ranting about why did they take it out, if they're going to put it back in, blah, blah, blah. Now, if transport is a topic that people have a lot of memories to share on Ottawa, so is shopping. Almost 9,500 people saw this picture of Bayshore, and numerous people commented about working there, what stores used to be there, what's up with the statues, where the statues go. Actually, I worked there as a lad and have a few stories about that, especially the day I had to fill in for the Santa Claus. Continuing with the shopping vein, we have this Ogilvy's bag, which garnered quite a few comments from people's experience. People remembered the bag, but they remembered the boxes, which always had the tartan on them. One person said they worked there, and they were and people were always coming into housewares to buy like a fork, but they would take a box. And they always wondered, like, how much cheap stuff from Woolworths was going into the Ogilvy's box and then going under the Christmas tree. Many other people remembered the malts in the restaurant. They remembered the old-fashioned elevator where the attendants took you to the top floor. They remember the Robbie Burns celebration in the cafeteria where the pipe band would play. Comments were like, oh, this brings back good memories. Oh, thanks for the memory, said another. But there was another dimension to the Ogilvy's story, and I want to mention that because this is one of those buildings that's gone, and there's a connection between the depths of people's memory and experience of that building, going there with their mom, getting the malts, whatever, and the fact that it is now no longer in existence. And this usually provokes a lot of comments about, you know, how did things go wrong? How do these buildings get knocked down? Here's one here. Why do they have to tear down heritage? The old buildings are all so beautiful. The reason I love visiting in Ireland, UK, etc., is they have so much history and they keep it. They do not tear it down. And so we get a lot of comments like that. If Ogilvy's is a hot-button topic to a certain extent, the Capitol Theater is another one. and once again, there's a kind of direct relationship between people's experience, their memories of being there, and the sense of outrage at the loss of this building. And, you know, of course, it's a bit of a historical mix-up because they're reasoning now about things that nobody thought at the time, but... Now we would say, of course, we would keep this building and we'll find some way to save it. And that, but this was the 70s. Loved the place. Made me feel like royalty. City should be ashamed. Blame the NCC. One guy said, oh, look at the OC Transpo bus. I think I rode that one the other day. And there was a whole series. Saw Kitty Wells, Tammy Wynette, George Jones, Gordon Lightfoot. Saw Wilson Pickett. Saw Cream there. Saw The Who there. Saw Jimi Hendrix there, who apparently opened for the Monkees. And then one last one. Saw Snow White there. What? Okay, so this brings us to the picture of the ride at the exhibition. This is the Roundup, which also got more than 9,000 views and had over 163 comments. Many of these comments were actually a debate about what the name of the ride was. Because I kind of suggested I didn't really know in my comment. And so there was a lot of debate about that. And that led to a lot of people showing pictures of other rides, like Gravitron and things like that. Many commented on how scared or sick it made them. I went on this ride once and I never went on a ride again. And although most of the comments were about the ride, once again, there's this annoyance about the loss of the exhibition or the Super X, as it came to be called. And so this brings us to the absolutely most popular picture on Lost Ottawa, which at the time got 16,416 views, which was 10,000 more views than we had likes at the time. So that was a big surprise to us, right? Like, well, how is this happening? How are people seeing this? How can 10,000 people see it? There's only 500 members of this community. And what's happening is it's being shared, right? It's a picture I just happened to take by accident. One day we were taking a person out for lunch because they were leaving work, and I said to myself, yeah, we're just going to lunch. I'll leave my camera in the office. And then I got there and I saw these guys putting the Dairy Queen sign on the trailer, and all I had was my iPod. So that's a picture from my iPod. And like a big idiot, I didn't think they were destroying it. I thought they were taking it away to fix it. And so I didn't actually post the picture until the Citizen had an article saying that it was destroyed. This got a record 210 comments, which, like I said, was ginormous for us at the time. And almost all of them expressed some sort of outrage. Corporate jerks. Are they nuts? That's wrong. It's ridiculous. Criminal act. Retro is in. So sad. And even the funny ones had a kind of sense of loss based on experience. When I was 10, I got in big trouble for throwing rocks at that sign. Sorry to see it go. Okay, so now we've kind of looked at some examples, and we want to get towards our conclusion here by kind of asking ourselves, is it history? We need to look into the meaning of things here. And I want to do it with this nice picture of what was a spa, a promo shot taken for the spa at Chateau Laurier. And I suggested that it called out for a caption. And many of them were quite funny. Rosemary's Baby takes up therapy was my favorite. But seriously, I started my talk with Michael of Rhodes for a couple of reasons. And the first is so that we would be able to make a kind of comparison with old school history. That kind of history, at least as I practiced it, I think it's fair to say, is generally about important people and important events. And it involves the creation of a distinct narrative around their importance. This narrative is created from facts, figures. It's about reasoning from facts, which is to say kind of history as a science. And in that way, it's kind of part of the Enlightenment project. It's modern. Political or military history is like this, I think. Social history has taught us that persons who don't have to be important, like kings and generals and presidents, but it still involves reasoning from facts to create a narrative that, in some way, makes the unimportant important after all. And we kind of did that with Michael Rhodes. He's actually a nobody in the big scheme of things, completely forgotten. We created a narrative that suggested why all 30 people should like him. So what I want to say is, you know, based on facts, reasonings, research, Enlightenment, modern. At this point, I think I would like to recall the day I was teaching at University of Toronto when I finally thought I understood what postmodern might be. And I observed that many of my students seemed to know that there were Greeks and Romans and Egyptians and there was World War II in Bosnia, but they had no idea what order they went in, what came after it. And my aha moment, my epiphany was to realize that, hey, that's exactly the way they experience history on TV, right? On the History Channel, for example, where you might have Napoleon, and then it's the Minoans, followed by the Civil War. Then you go back to the Greeks, then it's American Pickers, and then it's, you know, mysteries of the alien landing sites, all right? And it's kind of one thing after another all mixed up. Each might have a meaning and a narrative of its own, but there's no master narrative to provide any kind of order to this. And that's what I was thinking. Oh, yeah, this is what postmodern is. There's all these fragments of stories around. The kids even knew the significance. They knew the significance of Nazis. They just didn't know when they were. Right? So I hate to think Lost Ottawa as contributing to the collapse of the Enlightenment. but it is certainly broken up into these digestible fragments in which, you know, anything can follow anything, right? Swing set can be followed by the Queen in 1930 or whatever. There is no master narrative to order the events. It's not really about important people, and sometimes I have to say there's not too much reasoning from the facts. Most of the time, people don't bother with the facts. Nevertheless, I think it is history. I think it's about the past, at least. And things may not be connected by a master narrative, but there is a kind of mini-narrative to go with many of the pictures that are posted, especially these ones about loss, capital, Dairy Queen sign. There starts to be a story about how the government should have done something about that. It's like a trope or almost a genre. But if there's no narrative, master narrative to give the things meaning, they do get meaning directly through connection with people's lives, through their experience of the everyday. Things like eating, driving, working, seeing people, places, events, concerts, all these kinds of things that you just don't do as a normal citizen. And I think rather than a narrative that puts things in a story that gives things importance, what binds the pictures together is this bond of shared experience amongst the community. And with that is a kind of powerful sense of the legitimacy that ordinary people think their lives and memories have. Yes, they aren't generals and presidents, but that doesn't mean what they experienced is illegitimate. Okay, so What does this mean for 21st century history, and what does it mean for local history, where I claimed earlier that business model is broken? Well, I guess the good news, and especially for us historians who have heard all our lives about how boring history is, and how bored I was in high school to take history, et cetera, et cetera, I think the good news is that history is not dead. People actually like it, judging by Lost Ottawa. They are interested, and they will consume it if it's presented to them in the right way. Judging by Lost Ottawa, there's a powerful potential, I think, in the memories and experience of those people who are contributing. But how to take advantage of it? That would be the $50,000 question. At Lost Ottawa, we use small digestible fragments, combining kind of equal parts, well, maybe not equal. Maybe there's less learning and more entertainment. And this seems to work. People seem to like it. Could something bigger, though, something more coherent, something with a narrative be done? I think that's the $100,000 question, and it will require some experimentation. But I think that something like Lost Ottawa kind of indicates something else about history, if it's going to remain alive. And that is that if we're going to even write books, let alone do other things, it's really going to have to be about the last 60 years. Because, as I tried to point out with those pictures, that's what the people are really interested in, the last 60 years. And it has to be about the last 60 years because it needs to be about the subjects that connect the people directly to their experience. Or to put it the other way around, it connects directly to the lives of those now living, right? Eating, shopping, music, concert, events. I think that more extended histories can be written about those topics. And my sense is, given the potential, the interest that people show, that something more could be done and something more could actually be sold in that regard. I want to mention the built environment in particular, just because I had this idea that, okay, I'll do a built environment and that'll connect to people because there's buildings all around them and they pass them every day. And it seems I wasn't the first to have this idea. And in fact, there's quite a few people who had that idea. And what I think is interesting is that there's a lot of people in this space. And actually, that's one of the things I learned by starting this, is that there's actually quite a few people experimenting with new ways of presenting history on the web. What have I got here? I've got the Past Ottawa site, which is unfortunate because on this one you pull a slider and you go back and forth, and then you can see what it's like today and what it's like in the past. We have the Herbs Guy. I don't know if anybody knows who the Herbs Guy is, but he has a lot of excellent stuff on his site. And there's quite a few others, always kind of notably different products, though. I think they're notably different, but they're all based on the built environment as a key link to their own, if I could put it this way, viewers or customers, right? So there's a lot of experimentation going on. Okay, so finally, though, what about the business model, right? Because the ultimate question has to be, if there's going to be a survival of history, and particularly of local history, is will it pay, right? And that's the million-dollar question. If I could make a million out of it, I'd be really happy. So far, I have not made a cent. And it's taking a lot of time and effort. And it's really not sustainable over the long run without some kind of increase in resources. And that's where I think where maybe these other sites are actually paving the way by moving away from book publishing, that grant-getting model. But where do they have to move to? They have to move towards advertising, right? And this is, almost all academics are going to go, oh, what? No, sponsors are bad enough, which we experience in the museums. Right? ultimately, though, and maybe I have a okay. So that's these are some other sites where people are doing things on the thing. But I just wanted to point out that, like on my site, of course, there's this great ticket here where you could see Bruce Springsteen for $7.50, and I was at that concert, and he did play for like 3 hours, and they had to carry him off because he wouldn't stop. But my real point is there's a lot of advertising even on Facebook, and I don't get a cent. Okay. Ultimately, though, I think the thing I'm really trying to say is from Lost Ottawa about in connection with local history is that I really, really sense from what the people do on that site that there is a potential market. And it's just going to take some more time to develop a proper genre and a proper way to get that history to the people in a way that they will consume and maybe even pay for. Thanks very much.
You've been listening to a recording of David McGee's talk, Lost Ottawa, Facebook, Community, and History in the 21st Century. What does it all mean? You can find recordings of other talks at activehistory.ca.